Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Getting It Done, and I am your host, Dr. Walter Dean. It's very, very interesting that for some time I've been told that as a psychologist, it's important to look at all phases of psychology. And one of the phases in the whole system of the mind is sex. We should understand by now that sex does play a big role in our lives. In fact, today, if you ask people about why there was a divorce, it will be because of the lack of sex. In the past, families stayed together even though the sex experience was very poor. This is not the case today. So today's show will be on the topic of sex. We'll start with the young lady by the name of Maureen McGarth. She will be giving a 2-minute compelling presentation on different elements on sex, including masturbation, loneliness, cheating, and shame. Let's give a listen.
It's been said, if you never want to have sex again, get married. Sex is one of the most contentious issues in marriage today, second only to finances. There are many married couples that have not had sex for months, even years, and that's okay, as long as they're okay with it and happily married.
Good grammar and spelling are important, but if you want to write essays that inspire,
the problem arises when one person in the relationship wants sex and the other doesn't. According to a national newspaper survey of approximately 10,000 respondents, mostly married men, 75% were satisfied in their relationship, but more than 50% were dissatisfied with their sex lives. We're having sex, don't get me wrong, we're just having sex at the wrong time and with the wrong people. I'll get to that later. We're having sex before we get married, 10 years on average. So we are effectively in a long-term relationship and potentially quite sexually bored before we even mess up the marital bed. And that has its consequences. Most brides today do not have sex on their wedding nights. And 50% of men would not have married their spouse had they known their marriage was going to be sexless. So, everybody wants to know just how much sex are married people having, whether they are in heterosexual relationships or same-sex unions. You all want to know what's going on at the Joneses? Well, not much. Only about 7% of married couples set the sheets ablaze. Most married couples have sex a little bit more than once a week for the first decade of their marriage. It decreases after that. So they have sex about 58 times a year. And 20% of marriages meet the criteria as a sexless marriage. And that, defined by the experts, is sex less than 10 times a year. So why aren't we having sex in our marriages? Well, there's a little known chemical in the brain, conveniently called PEA, or P, and it's responsible for the elation, the excitement, and the euphoria that you feel when you meet somebody that you are sexually interested in. It's a fantastic feeling. This chemical is scourging through your blood vessels. You are so happy. That's how powerful this little chemical is. Well, what happens after 2 years, that chemical diminishes, as does sexual frequency. That's just about the time you might get married or may have conflict in your relationship. And that is why communication is key to great sex. Now, there's another reason we're not having sex in our relationship, and that has to do with the sex education that we provide. I'd like to share a story about myself. When I was a teenager, my mother came racing into my bedroom, and she said, "Maureen, please tell me you have not allowed a boy to French kiss you." She was feeling terrible that this sex education came a bit late, and I was feeling horrifically guilty as an Irish Catholic girl that I'd French kissed a number of boys. By that stage, we teach girls and women that sex is dirty and sex is bad or it's overrated. We say you're just going to get a sexually transmitted infection anyway, or you might get pregnant. This whole fear boost thing frightens women from enjoying sex. And we never talk about pleasure with girls and women or orgasm. And in fact, some women say orgasm's not important and that the journey is just as good as the destination. I disagree. Of course, I'm the one who French kissed all the boys as an Irish Catholic girl. It's like getting on a train with your lover, and you are going to the most pleasurable place on the planet. You are so excited. You're getting lubed up with all the free drinks they're giving you. This is amazing. And just before you reach your destination, he gets off and you don't. You get my point. Now, the sex education we have for boys and men, that's entirely different. It's a global program. It's free. It's accessible to everybody. And it's known as internet pornography. Fantastic. And it does nothing to teach men and boys about intimacy, which is really important to men and boys, or how to make love to anybody. Also, we have a paucity of information about sexual health for our LGBTQI community, and we need to add to that. Now, marriage can rapidly go from holy matrimony to holy hell with the finances, the kids, the houses, the illness. I mean, you may have signed up for sickness and health, but that was long before you'd ever witnessed a man cult. And how about that richer or poorer thing? Ladies, we're going to have to start going for richer. Most women today are working inside and outside of the home. We're doing the lion's share of the housework because, according to research, men don't feel they're that good at it. And we're bridging the gap between growing children and aging parents. We are exhausted doing it all and never doing it. And when we are doing it, we're checking our smartphones. 10% of people check their smartphones during sex. 35% immediately afterward. We are connected to the internet. We are connected to the internet and disconnected from our would-be lovers. Maybe this is the reason that the most common sex position for married couples is doggy style. No, it's not what you're thinking. Get your minds out of the gutter. This is the one where he's on all fours and begs, and she plays dead. I have a clinical practice where I see patients that have sexual dysfunction, and there are two questions that I ask everybody. And the first one is, are you sexually active? It's obvious. And when I ask women, they never say yes or no. Well, they never say yes, but they never say yes or no. They say, sometimes, sort of, I'm not sure. He is. Or they say, I'm married. I say, well, that means no to me. they say, yes, you're right, it is no. Most men complain that women never initiate sex. The reason for this is because, once again, the sex education we provide to women. Women falsely believe that female sexual interest, desire, precedes sexual activity, when in actuality, it is sexual activity that prompts sexual interest and desire. Sexual arousal emerges as a result of sexual activity. So, you guys, I know, intimacy is important to you. The most important question that reflects this that I received from you is, how much masturbation is too much masturbation? So, I just say, well, as long as you can go to work, you should be fine. And then I realize that that's perhaps all that you're doing at work. So, I know intimacy is important. You want to come home and you want to make love to your wife if you're in a heterosexual relationship. So after a long and quite possibly very hard day, you come home to a bit of chaos, perhaps. You've just got sex on the mind. And she says, did you remember the milk? And you're like, darn, the milk. I forgot the milk. Don't beat yourselves up about it. If not for the milk, we have Facebook, hormones. I'm feeling a little tired tonight. My stomach's sticking out. I'm feeling kind of fat. Can't do it tonight. Didn't we have sex last month? And you're like, that was actually last year. You don't get it. I mean, literally, you don't get it. But you're like, she's amazing. She works in and outside of the home. She does a great job with the kids. She volunteers. She even has time for girls' nights out. So I brought a friend home after one such girls' night out. As we approached her house, drove up, she looked up to her bedroom window, saw that the lights were on, and she said, Donnie's waiting up for me. Do me a favor, drive around the block a few times until the light goes out. I said, listen, you get in there and make love to your husband before somebody else does, because that is one thing that will increase a woman's sexual desire when someone else wants her man. Still unconvinced, she said, I decided to extol the health and beauty benefits that sex has for a woman. A youthful glow, better sleep, wrinkle-free skin. Keep driving, she said. There is a device that will increase anybody's sexual desire, and that happens to be the Mercedes-Benz 4MATIC Convertible SL. And it comes in 64 colors. But if that doesn't do it, the desire to have a baby will rev up any woman's sex drive. The problem is, having that baby is likely to kill it, along with any marital eroticism a couple may have had. Because a lot of people believe that motherhood and being sexual is incongruous. John followed me on LinkedIn for 2 years before he mustered up the courage to make an appointment about his sexless marriage. He'd been married for 7 years, and they had never consummated the relationship. Their parents were pressuring them to have children because they wanted grandchildren. When they came into my clinical practice, the second question that I ask everybody that enters my clinical practice, most unfortunately, is, have you ever experienced sexual abuse or unwanted sexual advances as a child? This is the first time this gentle man had learned that his wife had experienced sexual abuse as a six-year-old at the hands of her best friend's father. She thought sex was dirty. She hated sex. We need a worldwide moratorium on ending sexual violence on our children, boys and girls, because it happens to both. Healing from sexual abuse takes a lifetime. Ella had lived a lifetime. A widow, she said she wasn't sexually active, but she hoped to be. I thought, fantastic, somebody is going to have sex here. But she said, the problem, Maureen, is that these old guys can't get it up anymore. I said, well, Emma, you might have to go for a younger guy. She said, what's younger when you're 84? 70? Yes, some of you are saying. The hard truth is that men in their 30s and 40s may experience erectile dysfunction. Ella is going to have to go for a millennial. So you're all probably thinking, what's the big deal? Why treat my erectile dysfunction? Well, I liken the penis to a plane. If the pilot can't get the plane up in the air and keep the plane in the air for the entire trip, there's probably a problem with the engine. So if you can't get your penis up and keep it up for the entire sexual experience, there's likely a problem with your engine. Well, that's your heart. Erectile dysfunction is the canary in the coal mine, and it may signify cardiovascular disease. It may also indicate diabetes. So these two medical conditions, in addition to low testosterone, stress, substance use and abuse, excessive alcohol consumption, unresolved conflict, financial issues, all of those may contribute to low sexual desire, and you may end up in a sexless marriage. George presented to my clinical practice. At age 40, he decided to settle down. He was marrying a beautiful and accomplished woman in a few months. There's only one problem. George was gay. George could not bear to tell his family that he was gay because he felt it would have shamed the entire family. I said, George, you're going to end up in a sexless marriage. He said, tell me something I don't know. So George said to me, his plan was this. Well, when my parents die, I'm then going to divorce this woman and I'm going to marry the man that I love. And I said, George, you are not thinking straight. Sex is the barometer of the state of affairs in a marriage. People who live in sexless marriages report feeling frustrated, unloved, undesirable, unattractive, and the worst of all, lonely. And loneliness has been shown to increase vascular resistance and elevate blood pressure, and lead to an early death. You are more likely to die from loneliness than you are from obesity or excessive alcohol consumption. When I educate women and I say, if you're not having sex with your husband, someone else may, they get upset and they say that I'm blaming women for men's bad behavior, when in actuality, I'm doing a community service. You see, men in sexless marriages cheat to remain in that marriage in general. And women cheat to leave a sexless marriage. And women cheat too. Nobody ever thinks we do. We're just sneakier about it. We just don't get caught. We're socialized very differently. This is one thing we have on you guys. Women cheat with other men, and women cheat with other women. And technology has made cheating accessible for everybody. From the politician to the stay-at-home parent, that quick swipe right can lead to an online passionate love affair, from texting to sexting to secret phone conversations. The more two people communicate online, the more likely an in-person encounter will occur. But you can always blame your genes. The gene DN4N has been isolated in cheaters. And the sexless marriage, just the environment to turn on that gene. It's based on a system of pleasure and reward. The stakes are high, the reward substantial. It is the perfect cocktail to turn that love drug back on, PEA, and the cycle begins again. Historically, marriage was not based on mutual love, but rather it was an institution to acquire, of all things, in-laws, property, and physical labor. But at the turn of the 20th century in America, egalitarian ideals and the emerging Hollywood movie industry burdened marriages with promising romantic love forever. And now we're living forever. Fantastic. Congratulations. You get to have sex with the same person for the rest of your life. The second most common question that I hear from patients is, when does sex end? Well, a 44-year-old asked me, he said, when does sex end, Maureen? 65? I answered him this way. A 22-year-old asked me, when does sex end, Maureen? 35? Everybody's older until you get there. I'm here to tell you that sex never ends. If you're healthy, you can have a... you're healthy, you can have a great sex life well into your 80s and 90s. Sex is good for you. Sex is healthy, yet sex is shrouded in shame. In the ancient aristocracies, the wealthy men had courtesans for pleasure and concubines for quick sex. And the way we're going, computers will be our concubines. Internet pornography, our mistress of the day. Technology is fast replacing human connection at high speed. So how do you rev up the sexless marriage? Sex is about blood flow, sexercise. Every day you want to have a daily workout. It increases your agility, your stamina. Women will experience more sexual sensation when blood is flowing to the genitalia. It also helps to treat erectile dysfunction. Also, get help for any of the sexual dysfunctions you may have. Vaginal dryness, it's an issue that happens to women who are on the oral contraceptive pill, who are breastfeeding, perimenopausal, postmenopausal, and there are treatments for you. Pay more attention to your spouse than you do your smartphone. Spend more time in your bedrooms than you do your boardrooms, or your bedrooms are going to become boardrooms. Deal with your marital issues. Go to sleep in the same bed at the same time, and don't bring anything or anyone into your marriage except for a great sex toy and a darn good sex therapist. You must establish guidelines that govern those moments when you are struck by someone's attractiveness outside of your marriage. But don't think for a second that you have to have sex with the same person for the rest of your life. That's not what I mean. In your mind, that is. Fantasy is key. Your brain is your largest sex organ. And one more thing, I would like to leave you all off with a bang. Settle all marital arguments in the bedroom, naked.
We got the first installment on sexual intercourse in a marriage. Can a marriage couple ever have all three, love, marriage, and sex? Perhaps it's unrealistic since so many marriages end up in divorce today. Why is that? One reason might be that a reported 20% of all marriages are sexless, and that number is rising. Why have we lost the lust in our marriage? And I think the lady who just gave that presentation did a fantastic job, but we're going to move on to another consideration for women. It's called women's sexual pleasure. What are we really afraid of? And I'm not talking about myself as a male. I'm talking about myself as a individual who actually has to deal with the situation.
Yeah, how much cinnamon it takes to drop blood sugar?
Well, let's see what's going on here. So, let's see if we can pull up the one I want. Mm-hmm.
go back. Okay, see if we can find the one I wanted. Because here she is. Let's see if it allows me.
What did the experts say?
To listen to this lady right here. It's called Women's Sexual Pleasure. What are we are so afraid of?
He whispered to me in the library one day.
Hey, Sophia, can you look up the word sex? I want to see what it says in the dictionary. I had never heard of this word, so of course I was curious. Yeah, okay. My fingers slowly trailed down the page, eagerly searching for the letters S-E-X, S-E-X. But before I could land on the desired word, I felt a firm tap on my shoulder and a stern gaze hovered over me. Sat in the principal's office, terrified, yet unsure of my crime. He leaned in close and said gently, "Now, Sophia, why would a little girl like yourself be concerned with a word like that? I don't think your parents would be too happy to hear of it. But since this is your first time in here, I don't think they need to be told." In that simple moment, he created the first secret I would ever keep from my parents. And a lifelong curiosity about this shameful word spelled S-E-X. We're going to share a lot of secrets today, you and I. And in doing so, I hope that we can lift some of the shame many of us feel about sex. How many here have ever been catcalled by a stranger? Lots of women. For me, the time I remember best is when that stranger was a student of mine. He came up to me after class that night, and his words confirmed what I already knew. "I'm so sorry, Professor. If I had known it was you, I would never have said those things." I wasn't a person to him until I was his professor. This concept called objectification is the foundation of sexism, and we see it reinforced through every aspect of our lives. We see it in the government that refuses to punish men for raping women. We see it in advertisements. How many of you have seen an advertisement that uses a woman's breast to sell an entirely unrelated product? Or movie after movie after movie that portrays women as only love interests. These examples might seem inconsequential and harmless, but they're insidious, slowly building into a culture that refuses to see women as people. You see this in the school that sends home a 10-year-old girl because her clothes were a distraction to boys trying to learn. Or the government that refuses to punish men for raping women over and over. Or the woman who is killed because she asked a man to stop grinding on her on the dance floor. Media plays a large role in perpetuating the objectification of women. Let's consider the classic romantic comedy. We're typically introduced to two kinds of women in these movies, two kinds of desirable women anyway. The first is the sexy bombshell. She's the unbelievably gorgeous woman with the perfect body. Our leading man has no trouble identifying her and even less trouble having sex with her. The second is our leading lady, the beautiful but demure woman our leading man falls in love with, despite not noticing her at first or not liking her if he did. The first is the slut. She is to be consumed and forgotten. She's much too available. The second is desirable, but modest, and therefore worthy of our leading man's future babies, marriage material. We're actually told that women have two roles, but these two roles have a difficult time existing within the same woman. On the rare occasion that I share with a new acquaintance that I study sex, if they don't end the conversation right then, they're usually pretty intrigued. "Oh, tell me more." "So I do. I'm really interested in studying the sexual behaviors of pregnant and postpartum couples." At this point, I get a different kind of response. "Oh, huh. Do pregnant people even have sex?" Have you thought about studying sexual desire or orgasms? That would be interesting and sexy. Tell me, what are the first words that come to mind when you picture a pregnant woman? I asked this question in a survey of over 500 adults, and most responded with belly or round and cute. This didn't surprise me too much. What else do we label as cute? Babies, puppies, kittens, the elderly, right? When we label an adult as cute, though, we take away a lot of their intelligence, their complexity. We reduce them to childlike qualities. I also asked heterosexual men to imagine a woman that they're partnered with is pregnant, and then asked women to imagine that they are pregnant. And then tell me the first words that come to mind when they imagine having sex. Most of the responses were negative. Gross, awkward, not sexy, odd, uncomfortable, how, not worth the trouble, not worth the risk. That last one really stuck with me. We might think that because we divorce pregnant women and moms from sexuality, we're removing the sexual constraints, the constraints of sexual objectification. They experience less sexism, right? Not exactly. What happens instead is a different kind of objectification. In my efforts to explain this to others, one conversation led to the Venus of Willendorf. A Paleolithic figurine scholars assumed was a goddess of love and beauty, hence the name Venus. This theory was later revised, though, when scholars noted the sculptor's obvious focus on the figurine's reproductive features. Large breasts, considered ideal for nursing, a round, possibly pregnant belly, the remnants of red dye, alluding to menstruation or birth. They also assumed that she was meant to be held or placed lying down because her tiny feet don't allow her to be freestanding. She also had no face. For this reason, it was assumed that she was a representation of fertility and not a portrait of a person. She was an object. In the history of her interpretation, she went from object of ideal beauty and love to object of reproduction. I think this transition speaks more about the scholars who have interpreted her purpose than the actual purpose of the figurine herself. When a woman becomes pregnant, she leaves the realm of men's sexual desire and slides into her reproductive and child-rearing role. In doing so, she also becomes the property of the community, considered very important, but only because of her, because she's pregnant, right? I've taken the calling with the Willendorf effect, and once again, we see it reinforced in many aspects of her life. Has anyone here ever been visibly pregnant? Yeah, that's you, right? So how many of you ever had a stranger touch your belly during pregnancy? Maybe without even asking your permission first? Or told what you can and cannot eat by somebody who's not your doctor, your medical care provider? Or asked private questions about your birth plan? And then told why those choices are all wrong? Yeah, me too. Or had a server refuse to bring you a glass of wine? This one might give you pause, I know, but stay with me. This is a huge secret. It is actually safe to drink in moderation during pregnancy. Many of us don't know this because doctors don't trust pregnant women with this secret. Especially if she's less educated or a woman of color. What this tells us is this Willendorf effect, it's also classist and racist. It's present when the government reminds women with every new anti-choice bill that the contents of her uterus are not her own. Or when an OBGYN says, while it's safe to have sex during pregnancy, sometimes you never know. Better safe than sorry, right? She's denied basic privacy and bodily autonomy under the guise of be a good mother. We don't trust her to make her own decisions. She's cute, remember? Mm-hmm. When we tell women that sexual pleasure, excuse me, when you tell women that sex isn't worth the risk during pregnancy, what we're telling her is that her sexual pleasure doesn't matter. So what we are telling her is that she, in fact, doesn't matter. Even though the needs of her fetus are not at odds with her own needs. So medical providers such as the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology have the opportunity to educate about the safety of sex during pregnancy. So what do the experts say? ACOG actually has no public official statement about the safety of sex during pregnancy. Guidance from the Mayo Clinic is generally positive, but presented with a caveat. Although most women can safely have sex throughout pregnancy, sometimes it's best to be cautious. Some women don't want to have sex during pregnancy, and that's okay. Some women do want to have sex during pregnancy, and that's okay too. What needs to stop is society telling women what they can and cannot do with their bodies. Pregnant women are not faceless, identityless vessels of reproduction who can't stand on their own two feet. But the truth is, the real secret is, we tell all women that their sexual pleasure doesn't matter. We refuse to even acknowledge that women who have sex with women or women who don't want children even exist. Oh, it's just a phase. She just needs the right man to come along. Every time a woman has sex simply because it feels good, it is revolutionary. She is revolutionary. She's pushing back against society's insistence that she exists simply for men's pleasure or for reproduction. A woman who prioritizes her sexual needs is scary because a woman who prioritizes her sexual needs prioritizes herself. That is a woman demanding that she be treated as an equal. That is a woman who insists that you make room for her at the table of power. And that is the most terrifying of all, because we can't make room for her without some of us giving up the extra space we hold. I have one last secret for you. I'm the mother of two boys, and we could use your help. Even though my boys hear me say regularly that it's important for men to recognize women as equals, and they see their father modeling this, we need what happens in the world to reinforce what happens in our home. This is not a men's problem or a women's problem. This is everyone's problem. And we all play a role in dismantling systems of inequality. For starters, we have got to stop telling women what they can and cannot do with their bodies. This includes not treating pregnant women like community property. If you don't know her, don't even ask to touch her belly. We wouldn't anybody else. Don't tell her what she can and cannot eat. Don't ask her private details about her medical decisions. This also includes understanding that even if you are personally against abortion, you can still fight for a woman's right to choose. When it comes to women's equality, the two need not oppose one another. If you're somebody who has sex with women, prioritize her pleasure. If you don't know how, ask. If you have children, have conversations about sex as early as possible, because kids don't look up S-E-X in the dictionary anymore. They look it up on the internet. And when you're having those conversations about sex, don't center them on reproduction only. People have sex for many reasons, some because they want a baby, but most of us have sex because it feels good. Admit it. And regardless of whether you have children or not, support comprehensive sex education that doesn't shame our teenagers. Nothing positive comes from shaming teens for their sexual desires, behaviors, other than positive STD and pregnancy tests. Every single day, we are all given the opportunity to disrupt patterns of inequality. I think we can all agree that it's worth the trouble to do so. Thank you.
Wow.
Once again, we had the opportunity to hear another presentation on sex. Everybody has their own particular opinions. Our attitudes about women's sexual pleasure, especially during pregnancy, indicates our general feelings of their place in society. Charts are developed a path to show paths of improving gender equality, starting with sex. So, once again, we heard a female give a presentation about females, but also every now and then talk about men. In any event, I think women are the most authoritative individuals about their own bodies. No, there's no man on this planet Earth can tell a woman about what she's feeling as far as sex is concerned. She's the only one that can tell you that. We're going to move on, and this is Getting It Done, and I'm your host, Dr. Walter Dean, and we're going to move on to another one. Let's talk about sex, and let's see what happens with this one.
Could 5G already be dead in the water? If you still think 5G...
And third, women often feel like they can't ask.
I love you, Dad.
Love you all.
About the clitoris, orgasm, oral sex. I thought I should throw a few of those words out there right now so that we can all get prepared for what's coming over the next 15 minutes. Sex is a taboo topic, one that people typically shy away from speaking to large groups about, large groups that may even include their professors and family members. But I'm here talking about it anyway, and that's because I have a problem with the way that we are currently thinking about sex. And that's the reality that straight women often have a very different experience with sex than straight men do. And we live in a sexual world that revolves around the pleasure of the penis. In this speech, I'm going to start by talking about the ways that we define sex. I'm going to talk about the differences in orgasm rates and pleasure distribution for women and men. And finally, how we can move towards a more equal sexual experience. I want to preface this entire speech by specifying that I'm addressing heterosexual encounters only. So for the remainder of this talk, whenever I refer to women or to men, I'm referring exclusively to heterosexual and cisgender women and men. Additionally, this speech is directed towards college-aged women living in the current generation and sexual climate. So let's start with how we define sex. According to the Cambridge Dictionary, sex is listed as the activity of sexual intercourse. Sexual intercourse is defined by Merriam-Webster as heterosexual intercourse involving the penetration of the vagina by the penis. So, essentially, the definition of sex is just the definition of penetrative heterosexual sex. So what does this mean? Why does it matter how we define sex in the dictionary? Well, think about it for yourselves. What do you count as sex? When you're thinking to yourself, the people that you've had sex with, what acts are you thinking of? For a lot of people, this centers around penetration. Centering sex around the penetration of the penis is problematic not only for any sex that doesn't involve a penis, God forbid, but also for the straight woman's experience. This is because if you're in the 3/4 of women who don't experience regular vaginal orgasm, a statistic found by Harvard professor Elizabeth Lloyd's analysis of 33 studies regarding human sexuality. So if you're in the 3/4 of women who don't vaginally orgasm, then your orgasm is already considered extra. Your orgasm isn't even part of the textbook definition of what real sex is. The significance of the clitoris as the main and most consistent form of female pleasure and orgasm has been proven time and time again from researchers like Alfred Kinsey to the survey studies of Brianne Foss. So essentially, the pleasure that stimulates women's main sexual organ, which sometimes hard for people to accept, is actually the clitoris, not the vagina, is not even considered real sex, but something else, foreplay, something extra. Here is the reality of the sexual pleasure disparity. According to a large-scale survey of American adults conducted by Lauman and colleagues, women are having, on average, one orgasm for every three that men have during heterosexual encounters. One for every three. I've met women who thought that this number sounded pretty accurate, and I've met a lot of women who, in their experience, this gap was a hell of a lot larger. So why are men having so many more orgasms than women? There are two common cop-out explanations for this orgasm inequality. The first is that sex is a means for reproduction. If reproduction were the purpose of sex, then female orgasm may be unnecessary, because male orgasm is the way that reproduction would be achieved. Makes sense, except that this argument is outdated and just completely irrelevant, because reproduction is clearly not the purpose of sex in the majority of cases today, as you can see through the prevalence of many birth control methods. So then, why are people having sex? For pleasure, right? Because it's fun, because it feels good. So if the purpose of sex is pleasure and not reproduction, then this argument just does not apply. In a mutual pleasure-based encounter, theoretically, both parties should be benefiting equally from that encounter. This idea of the male orgasm as the means for reproduction represents an excuse for this orgasm to retain privilege, and nothing more. The second cop-out explanation is that it's just more difficult for women to orgasm excuse. There's this idea that women's bodies are somehow naturally just less capable of orgasm, and that the clitoris is elusive and difficult to operate. This so-called scientific explanation of sexual difference ignores crucial social factors that play a huge role in how we experience our sexuality, like hookup culture, anatomical misunderstanding, gender roles, and power dynamics. The myth that the female orgasm is naturally less easy to achieve can be proven false with two very simple statistics. The first is that according to research done by Alfred Kinsey, the average time that it takes women to orgasm from masturbation is the same as the average time that it takes men, which is about 4 minutes. So this means that if you know what you're doing, as in doing it to yourself, then sex differences in the time it takes to orgasm literally disappear. Additionally, women who have sex with other women have orgasm rates that are much higher than straight women's, orgasm rates that are almost as high as straight men's. This research was conducted at the Kinsey Institute by Dr. Justin Garcia and colleagues. The idea that the female orgasm is just as easy to achieve as the male orgasm can be a tough one for us to wrap our heads around, because we've been so conditioned to think of the male orgasm as the natural result of sex and a female orgasm as something extra. The problem does not lie in the nature of the female orgasm. When women are put in a situation where the penis is not involved, as in the situations I described before, those sex differences disappear. This means that it can't just be biology. Societal and gender dynamics must be at play here. But the problem is not men's alone. The problem lies in the way that all of us are approaching, viewing, and participating in heterosexual sex. Given the statistic I stated before that only about a quarter of women report regular vaginal orgasm, it shouldn't even be expected that women orgasm this way. But it is. There is a huge pressure put on women to orgasm vaginally, and when they don't or can't have an orgasm this way, there's a stigma and a sense of shame. Statistically speaking, the shame simply should not exist, because it should be common sense that women typically need clitoral stimulation in order to reach orgasm. This expectation for vaginal orgasm is one of the reasons why women are orgasming less. And this pressure to do so is one of the reasons why, according to a Brand Fossa's surveys, over 50% of women report having faked an orgasm before. That's the majority of women have faked an orgasm. Women are so trained to put men's pleasure first that it's almost as if they would rather please their partner by giving the appearance of an orgasm than actually have one themselves. By believing, whether consciously or subconsciously, that their orgasm is less important, women accept and reproduce subordinate sexual status. Sexual inequality can also be observed through the prevalence of certain sexual activity, like oral sex. According to Wendy Chambers' study on the sexual behaviors of college students, she found that women reported giving oral sex more and men reported receiving oral sex more. So why are men giving oral sex less than women are? An easy way for women to help fix this problem is to ask for oral sex, or to ask for orgasm, or for clitoral stimulation, or for whatever it is that they want. The problem is, asking for pleasure as a woman is a lot easier said than done. First of all, asking for pleasure comes with the assumption that you deserve it. Women always deserve it, but they often feel like they don't. It can be hard to ask for something from your partner when that person is making that act feel like an inconvenience or a chore. Second of all, women shouldn't have to be asking. Men should be making women's pleasure and orgasm an equal priority to theirs, period. And third, women often feel like they can't ask. I've known women who have asked for things that focus on their pleasure and been straight up told no and treated like it was an inconvenience, or told that sex was over now because the man had had an orgasm. A lot of times women don't feel like they can ask, or they just don't, but that doesn't mean that they don't want oral sex or that they don't want an orgasm. And when we're talking about sexual inequality, the differences skyrocket when it comes to casual, uncommitted sexual encounters or hookups. Sociologists Armstrong, Ingram, and Fogarty found in their study on college students that women were 56% less likely to have an orgasm in a first hookup than in a committed relationship. Women in this study reported their partner's complete disregard for their pleasure, and men in the study also reported being sexually inconsiderate. However, this does not mean that the orgasm gap doesn't exist for many committed women, because it really, really does. There are also a lot of women who have never had an orgasm from a partner. The reality of the situation is that women's pleasure and orgasm consistently become secondary, less important, less prevalent, and sometimes ignored altogether or even disrespected. Women internalize this belief that they don't deserve the same sexual experience as men, or that it's just not a physical possibility. Although I'd like to argue that the possibilities for women's pleasure are limitless. Women actually have a huge, varying capacity for orgasm. We're just not exploring it. I'd like to specify at this point that I don't want men's pleasure to go down. I don't want orgasm rates for men to decrease, and I don't want to diminish the importance of penetrative sex, because penetrative sex is really important. All I'm asking for is equality. I'm asking everyone who's listening, all genders, to open your minds and just consider that the way you're currently viewing sex might be oppressive. The experience of pleasure is different for every single person, but as long as our interactions have consent, respect, and a goal of equality, then we will have more pleasurable sexual experiences. It can be hard to stop viewing sex as penile-vaginal penetration only, and it can be hard to start viewing the female orgasm as just as expected and important as the male orgasm. It's hard to accept these things at first, but once you do, the reality of sexual equality becomes really easy. it's really all in the hands of the individuals participating. How long is it going to take for women to realize what they deserve, demand better, and not accept anything less? And when are men going to start treating their partners as equal, active participants in sex? And when are we all going to realize that the way we're currently viewing sex is centered around penetration and centered around the orgasm of the penis, and it's a good thing to question the validity of that? The trend of less pleasurable and less fulfilling sex lives for women limits the sexual power of women as a whole. If we could create a movement to abolish the sexual inequality and pleasure gap, if we could start viewing sex in a more equal and positive light overall, then we would be one big step closer to the reality of true gender equality. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to have to see about
it was that particular presentation. I wish that a lot of men had an opportunity to listen to it, because that young lady just gave a fantastic presentation about how much more a woman needs in order to be able to feel equal to a man. A lot of men just say, slam, bam, thank you, ma'am, and they're through. Whereas they should be making sure that their partner is really feeling the same thing that they feel, and more so. We're going to continue. We have I have two more presentations to give to make sure that are given. What a sex! This one right here is it's something about a little further, because you see, you're not going to always have a partner to do something, so maybe it's necessary to satisfy yourself. And this one right here is on the joy of masturbation, and this should take up the remaining amount of time for this show. Let's check it out.
10 years ago, we got a loan paper because we were confident we could deliver the American dream of home ownership to individuals.
Already knew it. My heart rate goes up, breath is faster, my legs shiver. It's just happening right now. You don't see it, which is fine, but it's quite uncomfortable. And I also feel anxious a bit. But there's one thing, how I especially work in this situation. Whenever and as soon as I start to talk about sex, the first time I say the word sex, everything calms down in me. It's like magic words. Of course, I feel joy and enjoyment when I start to talk about sex. But it's not general advice. It's just how I work. It's unlikely this technique would help you to manage your stress in the work or when you are in front of the other people in the same situation. It's not very good to start to talk about sex. But this example can help us to understand how joy and enjoyment work according to stress, according to uncomfortable emotions. Sylvan Tompkins, who was a great personality psychologist, he defined joy as one of natural effects which we feel from very early days of our life. He actually defined 6 and then 9 effects. Each of them has a specific expression on our face. And The specific feature of joy is that it calms you down. It relaxes your neural system. It actually decreases your neural firing. So when I am a little bit up higher, every joke, every joy you feel, even if it's a small smile on your face, is something that calms you down. So this is how joy works. If I ask you to just put joy on your face, how would it look like? What is the expression of your face when we have joy? Okay, we now have a perfect picture how much of you understand me now. Okay, this is joy. Thank you. This part understands me well. So, this kind of emotion that we have wide, lips wide open, and we have smile on our face. So, when we get to the point of the beginning of this presentation, in the beginning, when I was asked to do this speech, I was told, you know, Joy, you as a sex coach fit perfectly in this conference because we have joy as major focus on this of this conference. And we all think that joy and sex are very obviously connected to each other. It's very natural to think so. But then I started to think whether really joy is so obviously connected to sex, whether it's true or not. I just need to skip a few slides. I remember the first moment when I saw joy really can be a part of sex. It was in Jaya video. You probably don't know the videos because they are sex educational movies, and it's in her genital massage of men video. And she was expressing joy so obviously and naturally like I've never seen before. And, you know, it was kind of something happened in me because this face was somehow etched into my brain. And I started to think, why don't we do this more often? Why we don't do it in my personal relationships with my partners? Why I don't see it in you know, I've seen hundreds of hours of sex videos, but it's like, you know, you never see it. You have to see hundreds of hours of video if you are going to do school like I did. So it's not a very common feature of sex movies. And it took me a while to describe, it took me a while to find out that people are not very comfortable smile during sex, that most of us are afraid to express happiness during sex, during the phase when we are aroused. It's not very usual. Many of us have such an internal or outside talk like, no, I don't want to look silly. I don't want to look stupid, weird. I don't want to hurt my partner's feelings. I don't want to look like I'm not interested. I'm bored. Like, yeah, okay, do it. Continue. It's interesting. It should be because this gives many women orgasms, so do it continue because I'm normal. Okay. Even though it's a funny situation. And actually, sometimes the situation that you just need to be curious and curious and creative, that you allow yourself to feel a little bit different. So when you just now try to imagine that you, from some reason, end up in front of the mirror, you are just trying to imagine that you are doing sex in front of the mirror. Yeah? There are many good reasons why two consent adult people can end up in front of the mirror. It can be your preference, it can be part of the game. You maybe decided you would be more curious, but you anyway do it with closed eyes, even though in front of the mirror. And you can have a house full of children, and the only place you can find privacy is your locked bathroom, where is a big mirror, obviously. So you just are doing sex in front of the mirror. Yeah, in the middle of lovemaking. Can be mirror on the floor even. And you just see this. When you open your eyes, you see this kind of face on your partner's face. This is expression you see in the mirror. What would be your first reaction? Like, yeah, this is cool. No, I don't think so. Because when we see this in the middle of the stage of arousal, usually our first reaction is, what's wrong? What's wrong with me? Where did I do some mistake? What's wrong with the sex we do right now? It's not very common reaction. So joy can be very vulnerable situation. We can feel very openly. There is Brené Brown, who is doing research around many emotions. She's phenomenal, shame researcher, and if you've been watching that, you may be familiar with some of her talks already. And if you are not, I highly recommend them. And she says about joy. Joy is the most vulnerable and terrifying emotion or experience we can have. And she adds to this, the people with great capacity for joy can lean into vulnerability. So, in the other words, joy requires us to be open in such depth that we can be easily hurt by the other people. And it's not why we do sex. We usually expect something else. We expect us to be aroused and our partners to be aroused. We expect everything is perfect, everything goes perfect, up and down. And many other features. And we actually, what we expect the most, that we look serious. And our partner takes us serious. Because sex is a serious thing. It's not funny. But maybe later. But not in this situation. And maybe until you are not sadistic dominant or masochistic submissive, you certainly are not doing sex to feel vulnerable yourself or to see your partner in vulnerable situation. It's not the goal. But now it looks a bit that only tremendously kinky people can have joy during sex. And you don't need to be kinky to have joy during sex, but the truth is that there is no such a real intimacy like the moment where not only we are naked, but also our souls are naked in front of the other person. There's no such a real intimacy when there is no vulnerability at the same moment. And actually, the most intimate moments are born at the same time when you feel excruciatingly vulnerable. And we somehow, for many reasons, are not actually, we didn't learn to be accepted during this moment at such depth of intimacy, desire, the only thing. It's full acceptance and it is unconditional acceptance. But we didn't learn to be accepted during arousal while feeling joy. We didn't have training in this discipline. Now, I just want to talk about something else and then connect these parts together. Most of us train ourselves long before we engage in couple sex, regular couple sex, normal sex, how do you call it, doesn't matter. Most of us train ourselves in the ways how we work with excitement and joy. We train our bodies, we train our brains, we train our neural systems. It's connecting everything. We train our breath, we train our voices, we actually train many other things, muscles, postures, poses, whatever you can experience. We also program ourselves completely in the way how arousal enters our body, how it runs inside, and what kind of expression we allow ourselves to have on our faces. We are programming ourselves long before we engage in sex with the other people. Many people use masturbation as in the meaning of touching our most sensitive parts. We use this training for a long time. In one study, it's been estimated that men will ejaculate 2,000 times before he loses his virginity. So it's 2,000 times, although some of them are during sleep, doesn't matter, it's minor. And I did my estimation for me, and it was about 500 times of masturbation before I engaged, but I did it very young, so it's not very representative example. So there's a kind of training we have. And we actually, during this training, learn many things, but we also learn how to not do many other things. And it looks like we are allowing ourselves during masturbation and during arousal then only a certain range of emotions that we express. That's very limiting. And if I ask you now, who of you understand me, can you tell me who of you think that masturbation is normal, natural, or healthy, at least? We inject, thank you, and then fast go down. Okay. I just wanted to say that we are very liberal in Czech Republic, according to masturbation. We are, in comparison to the other countries, we are very liberal. We have very liberal approach to masturbation. But we live in double message society anyway. Even if we tell our children masturbation is okay, you can do it, it's fine. You don't need to be ashamed. It's healthy. It's natural. It's great. But, you know, when it comes to practice, we teach them completely opposite thing. Teach them, hide it when you do it. Don't show it to me. I can't watch it. Do it under your whatever you have on your your body. Do it somewhere else. I can't join you when you do it. I can't even do it with you. It's terrible, yeah? It's behind our border. So it's highly private activity. And yet we insist on the message, but it's very, very healthy and it's natural. It's good. It's good for your health, for everything. So, you know, it appears it doesn't matter how much parents are or are not open in this approach, because approach is not practice. In the end, the message you get is always the same. Something bad would happen if somebody sees me to touch my genitals. There must be something bad on touching my genitals at all. This is the result. And then we learn very intuitively when we are 3, 4, 5 years old. Many people, many women remember these kind of situations from their life. We learn very intuitively to feel guilty when we are discovering our bodies. We are curious. We are finding what feels good without any other purpose in this age. And then later in puberty, we learn how to do it fast, silently, and inconspicuously, for not to be caught by somebody. So this is the kind of training we get. And during puberty, we go through, right through the arousal fast way, and we go up to the highest point, to orgasm. There is no place to relax. There is no place to slow down, neither for joy or enjoyment. We have this scheme. We have this stereotype of using arousal in our body. Why would we slow down? Why would we have any joy? It's really, anyway, it's not real sex, right? Masturbation is not real sex. We take it more like service for our bodies. It's like car service. We take it technically, but not joyfully. It's definitely very private. Or somebody of you call to your friend or even to your partner, oh, I just did have great masturbation. I had so many smiles on my face. It was so joyful. I did this and that. And, you know, they're like, some of you. Or even better, do you share with your friends, oh, I just spent 2 days on masturbation, even with 20 other people. It was really great. I had so enjoyable moments like I've never had during the last 30 years. I suppose not. But the fact is that I lead these workshops. It's, for me, it's much easier than stand in front of you. And I know, I damn good know, how these experiences are difficult, and how it's really how much work it takes to share joy during masturbation with the other people, to be able to relax and slow down during your arousal, and to share it with the other people openly. It's a highly vulnerable situation, and it's, for some people, it results in very traumatic situations. Maybe this kind of stereotype comes really on the stage when you get out of biochemistry in your relationship, because this is where you get back. This is your stereotype. And when biochemistry fades away from your relationship and you get to the base of your arousal, you get to this point. So there's very, maybe one good news. You can retrain yourself. You can do it just right now. Maybe not right now here on this conference, because it wouldn't be allowed. It should be broadcasted in many other countries. But you can do it at home, or even bathrooms. There's many bathrooms around. Try to do it with joy on your face. Try next time when you masturbate, try slow down for a moment and just smile. Have this stupid face on your, you know, face. Because it really brings a different focus in your life.
I didn't see any reason to continue with this young lady. She's from another country, and it's very difficult to listen to the brokenness of the presentation that she's given. And I wanted to say a few things prior to us leaving, and then also see if I can sneak another one of these things in, which I think you might find extremely interesting if I can actually get us to that particular point. Because there's a thing that
staying safe with my family.
That might be important for us to listen to this last part.
2.5 centimeters. And it is covered with a foreskin, just like the head of the penis.
Let's listen.
Thank you.
And just like the penis, there come in different sizes, varieties, and shapes. So does the clitoris. It can be big or small or somewhere in between. A penis is an organ we know a lot about, and everyone knows it's sensitive. A penis has 4,000 nerve endings. The clitoris acts up to 8,000, twice as much. And this makes it the most erogenous zone of the human body. The anatomical function of clitoris is to provide sexual excitement, and it is important for women's orgasm. And the good news is that it can be stimulated from many directions. External, direct, lateral, anal, combination of these. And this gives long, short, or series of orgasms. There is so much more to the clitoris than most people know. And believe me, you're not alone not knowing. During the last 6 months, I have shown this plastic model of a clitoris to hundreds of people of all ages and backgrounds. Hardly anyone can tell what it is, including medical personnel. There are more pictures of the whole clitoris in any books or web pages. Children don't learn about it in school, and teachers, nurses, and doctors do not learn about these organs during their studies. And the more I study, and the more people I talk to, I understand that there's a major lack of knowledge and research about female sexuality. The information is fragmented, and there are few or no real authorities on the subject yet. Back in the 18th century, people believed that the woman needed to have an orgasm to become pregnant. It was also believed that the man and the woman needed to have a simultaneous orgasm for the woman to become pregnant. We can only imagine their focus on the clitoris back then. But the bad guy in this story is Sigmund Freud, the father of the psychoanalysis. According to Dr. Freud, real female orgasms was achieved through vaginal penetration. If the woman was not able to get an orgasm through penetration, she was mentally ill and in need of treatment. Female clitoris was for girls, not for grown women. Today, we know better. An interesting American study from 2017, including 52,000 participants, tells that there's a considerable gap between lesbian and straight women when it comes to orgasms. 65% of heterosexual women usually or always orgasm when they're sexually intimate. For lesbians, the number is 86%. Why is that?
is their secret. Women that orgasm more frequently recommend more oral sex, longer lasting sex, asking for what they want in bed, talk to each other, and also try new sexual positions. Women are more likely to orgasm if their last sexual encounter included deep kissing, manual genital stimulation of the clitoris, and also oral sex in addition to vaginal intercourse. But why should we all get to know the clitoris? Because we care about the health of our daughters, sisters, and girlfriends. We know that good and mature sexual health is a roadmap to good mental and physical health, not to mention all the joy and pleasure it brings. Studies show that regular orgasms strengthen the immune system. It makes you look younger. It is good for the heart and for your sleep, and it reduces the feeling of stress. I guess you all want some of that. So my message to you today is to get a closer relationship to the clitoris. Be curious. Go out there and spread the word. And get yourself a good shower head. Thank you.
That's called the unknown greatness of the clitoris. Through her research, Maria discovered a major general lack of knowledge of the female sexual organ called the clitoris. She presents to us the unknown greatness of the clitoris. She is heading the organization called Sex Samfunn, from Norway, largest clinic for sexual and all kinds of erotic behavior. In our presentations today, what we have been able to identify and very clearly is some of the women that gave presentations were from this country, and two were from another country. One was from the Czech, and the other one was from Norway, the last two. And the other two were young ladies who were working on their PhDs. There was a lot of study being done about sexual behavior because for years people it's been a taboo to talk about it, to express it, and to actually sit down and learn about it. That's one reason why young men don't pay that much attention to the needs of a woman, because they were never taught to do that. In any event, this has been Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean. And what I'm going to do is continue with this particular topic for a while. I had to get away from some of these other topics that I've been dealing with because they're sometimes very stressful, and I have to do the research before presenting them. So this was very interesting, to say the least. So hopefully you enjoyed this, and as much as I've enjoyed presenting it and providing it. We will be back again. Today is Friday, and we'll be back again on Monday from 5 to 6 on the same topic. So those of you who are interested in knowing more about this particular topic, please pay close attention and be ready to listen to it, because I'm going to bring it to you. This has been Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean. Have a good evening and a good weekend.